Well, thank you, and hello to everybody. Looks like there might be a few people gone today, but there are a few visitors too to make up for it, so that works out well. Scott and I didn't compare notes or anything on the messages, but mine kind of meshes in with his pretty well, or kind of, well, you'll find out, Scott. You're giving me that puzzled look. But the title of this message is Deciding with God, Deciding with God. Our lives are made up of decisions and choices, and there's a saying that our lives are a sum total of the choices we have made. That saying appears to be attributed to a motivational speaker by the name of Dr. Wayne Dyer. Well, how do we learn to make decisions? How does God teach us to make decisions? How does God work with us to make decisions? And Scott gave some examples of that in a way, and when things didn't go the way he thought they should, they actually turned out better. Well, as infants, we're totally dependent on our parents or other caregivers to look after us. And initially, our parents have to decide what our needs are and what needs to be done for the child and do those things for the child. And as the children grow older and are able to understand directions, the parents teach them how to do things that are within their capability. And the parents decide what they must continue to do for their children and what the children are able to learn, when the time is right, and how to teach and train them. And as children, we don't know what we don't know, and new things have to be introduced that we wouldn't have known to even ask for. Well, God works in the same manner in training and preparing us for his kingdom. He has a master plan that helps each of us to learn and to grow and to learn how to make right decisions. God's working with every one of us. There is a parallel between how parents teach their children and how God teaches us. But interestingly, we can see a third parallel when we look at how God worked with and taught ancient Israel. And that's what I want to look at in this message. Throughout the Bible, Israel faced a number of problems and a number of choices. Sometimes they chose to work with God, sometimes without God, and other times even against God. They were convinced that they could make their own decisions at times. Sometimes they worked, sometimes they didn't. But by looking at a pattern of the ways God worked with them and taught them, we could see how he might work with us today. So in this message, I'm going to review three phases of decision-making in the Bible and apply them to our lives. Three phases of decision-making. And I call them phases because there seems to be a progression from one to the next. The first phase is we are told without asking. An infant is completely dependent upon its parents. The infant can't do anything on its own, really. Parents need to tell them what to do. And during the early years, the parents decide what needs to be done. And he must either do it for the child, or once the child gets older, the parents can tell the child exactly what to do. And they have to describe it in great detail at first, just so the child understands. An example is Adam and Eve. Might consider that Genesis 2, verses 15 through 17. Genesis 2, verse 15, then the Lord God took man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. For in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. Why did a God have to describe this in more detail to Adam? Adam found himself in the midst of a lush garden. He didn't know what was edible and what wasn't. To him, all the trees may have looked pretty much alike. They had a trunk and leaves and stems. His instinct might have been to try a small bite and decide whether it was good or not based on just the taste alone. And if the fruit or nut or leaf or bark or flower or root of one plant was good, he would probably assume that the same items were good on all the trees, at least until he tried them. So we don't know whether the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was discernibly different from the other trees or not, but God had to instruct Adam and specifically tell him not to eat from that tree. And then parents, similarly with their children, need to tell their children about things that are hot or cold or poisonous. If a child sees a cup of water and drinks, he knows it's good. If he gets his hands on a cup of a hot liquid, hot coffee or tea, he could burn himself, he or she could burn himself. So parents need to teach our children what's good and what isn't good. And sometimes it works the other way. They have to teach them that broccoli and liver are really good for them, because instinctively, I don't think kids would jump on that. Well, then Eve is created, Genesis 2, verses 18 through 20. And the Lord God said, "It's not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him." Out of the ground, the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to Adam to see what he would call them. And whatever Adam called each living creature, that was its name. So Adam gave names to all cattle, to the birds of the air, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper comparable to him. I can't imagine what a job it would be to give a name to all of these and then to remember what name he had decided to call them. But somehow God worked all of that out. Before Eve came along, Adam didn't know what he was missing. He wouldn't have known what to ask for. He knew he was a man, and he just assumed that every living being would be like him. He could probably see that there were males and females among the animals, but God had to create a mate for him, a helper, as he says. Another example is Noah. God had to work with Noah and tell him what to do and why and how. We can read about Noah in Genesis 6, verses 5 through 8. Genesis 6, verse 5. "Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, 'I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them.'" So God was ready to just destroy everything, everybody, and start over. But verse 8 of Genesis 6 says, "But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord." God saw something special about Noah and decided that he was going to work with Noah. Noah probably saw wickedness around him, but not to the extent that God did. And on his own, Noah wouldn't have had any idea about how to save himself. But God gave him instructions. God had his own plan of how he could do this, how he could destroy mankind except for Noah and his family. In Genesis 6, verse 13, "And God said to Noah, 'The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth.'" And he's talking to Noah. He says, "Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. and this is how you shall make it. And you can imagine what was going through Noah's mind as God's telling him, make yourself an ark. An ark, what's that? Of gopher wood. What's gopher wood? You'll have to show me what gopher wood is. And pitch, I don't know what pitch is. You'll have to tell me exactly how to build this, and God did. God said, and this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. And Noah might have thought, well, I don't need that big a vessel for my family. There's only a small number of us. Why are we making such a huge ark, a boat? In verse 16, you shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it to a cubit from above, and set the door of the ark in its side. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. He's going into great detail, and I'm sure he would have described in more detail, telling Noah exactly how to do it. Verse 17, and behold, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh in which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, of animals after their kind, and of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind, two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. So Noah didn't have to go out and trap these or capture them somehow and get them onto the ark. God was going to do that for him. In verse 21, and you shall take for yourself of all food that is eaten, and you shall gather it to yourself, and it shall be food for you and for them. So Noah had to gather food not just for him and his family, but he had to gather food for all the animals too. In verse 22, thus Noah did, according to all that God commanded him, so he did. And this wasn't done in a matter of weeks or years. It took several years. Maybe 100 years, I don't know, we don't know exactly. But it took the amount of time it took. God gave him whatever time he needed before the floods came. So God had to tell Noah what to do. He told him how to do it, and he told him why. Noah wouldn't have known he needed to do this or ask about it. God also gave him enough time to build the ark and load it with the animals and food before the floods came. So God was telling Noah what to do. He also worked with Abram. Another example in Genesis 12, verses 1 through 9. Now the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Abram, otherwise, if God hadn't called him and told him to do this, he likely would have continued life just as he had before, just as his parents had and others around him. He wouldn't have known that he had to get out of the country, but God told him to do it. And it says in verse 4 of Genesis 12, so Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. 75 years old today sounds like a kind of a ripe old age. You're pretty settled in life, and not necessarily looking forward to making some drastic changes to your life. But people lived much longer then, so I don't know what today's equivalent of 75 years would have been, much younger in life probably. But it says, then Abram took Sarah, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem, as far as the terebinth tree of Morah, and the Canaanites were then in the land. Verse 7, then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants I will give this land. So once they were there, Abram saw purpose. Oh, this is going to be the land of me, our family, and our descendants. And it says, and there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. And I kind of wonder, did he know how to build an altar or what an altar should look like? I'm not sure, but if he didn't know, God told him, God worked with him. Verse 8, and he moved from there to the mountain east of Bethel, and he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. So Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south. God had spoken to Abram and told him to leave Haran and go to the land of Canaan, to Shechem, Bethel, and the land that God was going to give him. Abram had to be told all this. Otherwise, he and his family would likely have remained in Haran. So just as children trust their parents, Abram trusted God. It isn't recorded how much God told Abram about how this all would happen. Another test came later, as we're all familiar with. That's with Abraham and Isaac. Genesis 22, verses 1 to 3. Now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, here I am. Then he said, God said, take now your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. I can't imagine what that would have been like as a parent. Parent with an only son that Abraham had waited for and longed for and loved. Now God was saying, now I want you to sacrifice him. Use him as a burnt offering. But God trusted him. Verse 3, so Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son. And we know the rest of the story. I won't go into that, how Isaac was asking, well, I see where we're going, but what is your sacrifice? And Abraham had to tell him all that. God was telling him things that he just would not have even thought to decide on his own. Another example, Jacob. This is mentioned in Genesis 35, the first seven verses. Genesis 35, verses 1 through 7. Then God said to Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there. Make an altar to God who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother. And Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, put away the foreign gods that are among you. Purify yourselves and change your garments, and let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in the way which I have gone. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods which were in their hands and the earrings which were in their ears. Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree, which is by way woods by Shechem. And they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were all around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. So God was protecting him. So Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. And he built an altar there and called the place El Bethel, because there God appeared to him when he fled from the face of his brother. Jacob just had to trust in God and his word, just like children have to trust in their parents and their parents' word. Jacob's family and others with him had to trust in Jacob because God had instructed him. This is not something Jacob would have done on his own. One more example of Moses. This is in Exodus 2:23 through 3, Exodus 3, verse 4. And we know this is the example of the burning bush. Exodus 2:23. Now it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Egypt, Israel, groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of the bondage. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them. And then chapter 3. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the back of the desert. It came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. Trying to put myself in that position, if I saw that, I would probably tend to run away from it rather than to figure out why it was there. But I don't know, God was working with Moses. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Exodus 3, verses 5 through 11. Then he said, do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now, therefore, and this is still God speaking to Moses, come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? And of course, we remember the example how Moses came up with all kinds of excuses. Why pick me? I'm not a good speaker, and people won't believe me. And he had all other reason why he shouldn't go. He said, send Aaron instead. But God had a plan in mind, and Moses was going to fulfill that plan. Now, notice in all these examples that I've given that God initiated the contact and the actions. God told them what to do and how to do that. They were taught directly by God, just as children have to be taught directly by their parents. And it wasn't just these people. There's a list of at least 22 people by name who God spoke to directly. And some of these, can just read some of them: Cain, Noah, Job, Abimelech, Isaac, Jacob, Joshua, David, Nathan, Solomon, Elijah, Isaiah, Manasseh, Jonah, Ezekiel, Hosea, Haggai, Zechariah. And there were others. This isn't a complete list by any means, but God did work directly with people and tell them what to do. This is still a phase one. People have to be told directly what to do. So children learn by watching and imitating their parents. They need to be told and guided in whatever chores or tasks are expected. They need to be told to pick up their toys, tying their shoes, need to be told how things work, need to be shown nature and its varieties of plants and animals, which are good to eat, which are friendly as far as animals go. And parents need to set limits on the food their children eat, limits on the amount of time for play or games or videos or their phones or whatever. Need to tell them when to nap and go to bed. Our spiritual lives begin the same way. In some cases, God practically forces us to make a decision when we didn't even know one was necessary. But God works with us. He tells us directly. And this is first phase, telling people directly what to do and, if necessary, how to do it. The second phase of making decisions is we ask and we receive a definite answer. Children will ask their parents about how to do something, ask for permission to do something. They need help in making decisions. They're at the point where they know there might be a question to ask and a decision to be made, but they don't yet know what to do about it. The parents then usually might have a direct answer, or they can guide the child into making the right choice. And hopefully, in many cases, most cases, the child listens and learns and obeys. Spiritually, we ask God, and he initially anyway tells us exactly what to do. The next phase of growth involves asking God, relying on God for our decisions. He is willing and desirous to help us, but we need to do our part by asking him. One of the more interesting examples of this is the Urim and the Thummim. And Scott was going into a little bit about how God makes decisions or can direct us. We don't really know what this Urim and Thummim were. They're associated with a priest's breastplate or ephod, and they provided a way for God to communicate with his people. We're told that the breastplate contained 12 jewels, one for each tribe of Israel. And the ephod itself was a sleeveless garment that Jewish priests wore. Exodus 28 describes what this breastplate was. Exodus 28, verse 26, says, "You shall make two rings of gold, put them on the two ends of the breastplate, on the edge of it, which is on the inner side of the ephod, and two other rings of gold you shall make, and put them on the two shoulder straps underneath the ephod toward its front, right at the seam above the intricately woven band of the ephod." He's giving very detailed, precise instructions about this breastplate and the Urim and Thummim. "They shall bind the breastplate by means of its rings to the rings of the ephod using a blue cord." I have no idea why it had to be a blue cord, but that's what it says. "Using a blue cord so that it is above the intricately woven band of the ephod, and that the breastplate does not come loose from the ephod. So Aaron shall bear the names of the sons of Israel on the breastplate of judgment over his heart when he goes into the holy place as a memorial before the Lord continually." And verse 30 says, "And you shall put in the breastplate of judgment the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be over Aaron's heart when he goes in before the Lord. So Aaron shall bear the judgment of the children of Israel over his heart before the Lord continually." Again, we don't know exactly what they were. They may have been two additional jewels And the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia indicated that they may have reflected light in a certain manner to indicate a yes or no answer. So if they asked a yes or no question, maybe the way the light reflected off these stones would guide them into whether God was telling them yes or no. We don't know how, but we know that God somehow used them to tell Israel what the decision would be. In 1 Samuel 23, verse 9, 1 Samuel 23, verse 9, when David knew that Saul plotted evil against him, he said to Abiathar the priest, "Bring the ephod here." Then David said, "O Lord God of Israel, your servant has certainly heard that Saul seeks to come to Keilah to destroy the city for my sake. Will the men of Keilah deliver me into his hand? Will Saul come down as your servant has heard? O Lord God of Israel, I pray, tell your servant." Then it says, "And the Lord said, he will come down." So somehow God had a way of using these stones, this breastplate, to give them a yes or no answer. Then David said, "Will the men of Keilah deliver me and my men into the hand of Saul?" The Lord said, "They will deliver you." So David and his men, about 600, arose and departed from Keilah and went wherever they could go. Then it was told Saul that David had escaped from Keilah, so he halted the expedition. Now notice that the questions in this example were all yes or no questions. Will the men of Keilah deliver me? Yes or no. Will they deliver me and my men into the hand of Saul? Yes or no. And God answered somehow, giving them a yes or no answer. This was used for major decisions, and there was probably a formal ritual of some type involved in the asking, but the answer that came back was specific. They asked a yes or no question, and they were given a yes or no answer. People had absolute confidence that the answer was from God. Now, some of the examples in the Bible show that there was also some way for God to elaborate, provide more detail. And we can see this in Judges 20, verses 18 through 28. This is during the time of Israel's war with the Benjamites. Judges 20, verse 18. Then the children of Israel arose and went up to the house of God to inquire of God. They said, "Which of us shall go up first to battle against the children of Benjamin?" The Lord said, "Judah first." Now, we don't know how this answer might have come. Was it broken down? Did they answer, "Will this tribe go first? Yes or no. Will this tribe go first? Yes or no. Will Judah go first?" And they got a yes answer. That may be how it worked. We don't know. It doesn't describe it. So the children of Israel rose in the morning and encamped against Gibeah. And the men of Israel went out to battle against Benjamin. And the men of Israel put themselves in battle array to fight against them at Gibeah. Then the children of Benjamin came out of Gibeah, and on that day cut to the ground 22,000 men of the Israelites. And the people, that is the men of Israel, encouraged themselves and again formed the battle line at the place where they had put themselves in array on the first day. Then the children of Israel went up and wept before the Lord until evening and asked counsel of the Lord. Again, they were asking for God's help, saying, "Shall I again draw near for battle against the children of my brother Benjamin?" And the Lord said, "Go up against him." So this in itself was a yes or no question, but we don't know the details of the questioning or what might have led up to it. Continuing in the chapter, verse 24, so the children of Israel approached the children of Benjamin on the second day. Benjamin went out against them from Gibeah on the second day and cut to the ground 18,000 more of the children of Israel. All these drew the sword. So they lost 18,000 of their own men. Then all the children of Israel, that is all the people, went up and came to the house of God and wept. They sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening, and they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. So the children of Israel inquired of the Lord. It says the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, stood before it in those days, saying, "Shall I yet again go out to battle against the children of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease?" And this time they got the answer they were hoping for. And the Lord said, "Go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand." So it took a long time to get to the answer, to get through all of this, but God did answer them. There are times, though, when God chose not to answer. There's an example of that in 1 Samuel 28, verse 6. You don't need to turn there, but 1 Samuel 28, verse 6 says, "And when Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by the prophets." So sometimes God thinks it best not to provide an answer. But it is very reassuring to get an answer and to know that it's a specific response, either from your parents or from God. In our physical lives, we come to an age where we ask our parents for toys, for staying up late, visiting friends overnight, getting a pet, how to save, spend money. And generally, the parent decides and the child obeys. Spiritually, we ask God for help, and he leads us to an answer. Or he may decide he's not going to answer. He's going to give you the means to decide for yourself. The third phase of decision-making goes beyond that. Up until this time, we've had pretty much yes and no questions and answers being provided. But the Urim and the Thummim aren't recorded after the time of David. So they didn't have that. They didn't go to this breastplate or these jewels, whatever they were. And according, again, to the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, it says, the basic reason for their demise seems to have been that God was weaning his people away from a physical means of revelation to a greater dependence on his word as written or as spoken by the prophets. Thus, the prophets grew in importance at the expense of the high priest in answering inquiries with divine revelation. This meant that the easy certainty offered by a mechanical aid for revelation, such as the Urim and Thummim, in whatever manner they may have functioned, gave way to the more difficult application of the norms of true and false prophecy. This development demanded greater spiritual discernment. Consequently, the priestly duty of teaching the will of God received an even greater stress than before. People had to know the will of God so they could determine what the answer should be. God gives some examples of this. Deuteronomy 13, verses 1 through 4. Deuteronomy 13, verse 1. If there arises among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and he gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or wonder comes to pass of which he spoke to you, saying, "Let us go after other gods, which you have not known, and let us serve them," you shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God is testing you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. You shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him and keep his commandments and obey his voice. You shall serve him and hold fast to him. So it gets to the point where we cannot rely necessarily on everything that we hear from others. This talks about a prophet or a dreamer of dreams who, in this case, is a false prophet. And even if this false prophet offers a sign of some kind, if he tells you to step away from God, you know he is not from God, and you should not listen to him. So the Lord is testing you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. In Deuteronomy 18, verses 20 through 22, says, "But the prophet who presumes to speak a word in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, or who speaks in the name of other gods, that prophet shall die." So there is just no room in God's world for false prophets. Verse 21 of Deuteronomy 18, "And if you say in your heart, 'How shall we know the word which the Lord has not spoken?' When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing does not happen or come to pass, that is the thing which the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. You shall not be afraid of him." How about Absalom? Absalom was in the midst of treason and war against his father David. 2 Samuel 16, verses 20 through 23. 2 Samuel 16, verse 20, "Then Absalom said to Ahithophel, 'Give counsel as what we should do.' And Ahithophel said to Absalom, 'Go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that you are abhorred by your father. Then the hands of all who are with you will be strong.' So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the top of the house, and Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. Now the advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one had inquired at the oracle of God. So was all the advice of Ahithophel, both with David and with Absalom." Absalom asked for God's advice. He asked for opinion from a trusted counsel. But he didn't like the answer. So he shopped around a little bit for a second opinion. 2 Samuel 17, verses 5 through 13. "Then Absalom said, 'Now call Hushai the Archite also, and let us hear what he says too. And when Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom spoke to him, saying, 'Ahithophel has spoken in this manner. Shall we do as he says? If not, speak up.' So Hushai said to Absalom, 'The advice that Ahithophel has given is not good at this time.'" He adds, "at this time," kind of saying, well, he usually gives good advice, but this isn't the right time for what he's telling you now. Verse 8, "For," said Hushai, "you know your father and his men, that they are mighty men, and they are enraged in their minds like a bear robbed of her cubs in a field. And your father is a man of war and will not camp with a people. Surely by now he is hidden in some pit or in some other place. And it will be when some of them are overthrown at the first that whoever hears it will say, 'There is a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom.' And even he who is valiant, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will melt completely. For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and those who are with him are valiant men. Therefore, I advise that all Israel be fully gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba, like the sand that is by the sea for multitude, and that you go to battle in person. So we will come upon him in some place where he may be found, and we will fall on him as the dew falls on the ground. And of him and all the men who are with him, there shall not be left so much as one. Moreover, if he is withdrawn into a city, then all Israel shall bring ropes to that city. We will pull it into the river until there is not one stone found there." So that's one thing we have to be aware of. We can't shop around looking for someone to give us the advice we're looking for. As we grow and mature physically, we need to take more responsibilities for our own decision. A teenager may ask a parent about a decision. The parent offers advice, but often leaves the final decision up to the son or daughter. If parents continue to make all decisions, their children may have problems making their own decisions later in life. And I don't know if you've come across someone like this, someone you ask a question and the person just says, I don't know. And that's the only answer he knows how to give. He doesn't know how to make a decision. So we need to make sure that we learn, that our parents teach the children how to make decisions. Spiritually, God begins to leave decisions up to us. He's there to help. He'll hear our prayers when he asks. He'll point us toward a decision, but we must decide and take responsibility for our decision. So in this message, we've looked at three phases of decision-making that can apply to parents and children, to God and Israel, and to God and us today. The first phase is we're told to do without our asking. Our parents say, do this. They have to work that way with their children. The second phase is we ask what to do and are given a direct, definite answer. Ask our parents, can I go to or do whatever? And the parents say yes or no. They give a definite answer. And the third phase is we ask what to do, and we're given advice, but we are responsible for making the decision. And those are all points of growth in decision making, and God is involved in those and involved with us. So just as Israel grew and matured in their relationship with God, and just as we grow and mature physically, we also need to grow and mature spiritually. Ultimately, it's not how God answers that matters, but that he does answer. God uses the method that's right for the circumstances, for the individual, and for the times. God is there to help, of course, but we need to do our part. No matter how the answer comes, whether we're being led in a certain direction we were not aware of, or whether we ask of God and he provides an unmistakable response, or whether the time is not right for an answer at all, we need to have the faith that the answer does come from God. We have the responsibility of bringing our request to God, and no matter how God chooses to respond, we then have the responsibility of deciding whether and how to obey God.